From the Sky News Centre at 6, two young brothers have been sentenced to at least 5 years in a secure children's home for brutally torturing two other young boys. The case has brought about an unqualified apology from Doncaster Council over the failings of its social services. Nick Jarman is the Children's Department's director.
The serious case review has been published today. That now enables us to take this forward to look into where people may have been at fault. And I can assure you, and let me repeat this, assure you, that where disciplinary action needs to be taken, it will be taken, and it will be taken firmly.
A mother branded evil has been jailed for life for torturing her partner to death. Claire Nichols must spend at least 32 years in jail for the prolonged killing of 35-year-old Andrew Gardner in County Durham. Gordon Brown will face the Iraq inquiry before the general election. The Prime Minister says he has nothing to fear. A mother who pretended her son had a series of life-threatening conditions to gain publicity and financial rewards has been jailed. Lisa Hayden-John caused her son harm by getting him treated for things like cerebral palsy and cystic fibrosis, which he never had. The city minister says Barack Obama's plans to curb the size of banks and limit trading activity will not necessarily be copied in the UK. Lord Miners says the British banking system is already much safer than it was. More musical stars have been signed up to take part in the Everybody Hurts charity single for Haiti. Ex-Federal Judge Simon Cowell's already called on Rod Stewart, Leona Lewis and James Morrison. Showbiz writer Martel Maxwell says it's bound to top the charts.
Cowell is not just going for his acts. You know, he wants Rod Stewart. They're approaching people like Paul McCartney to see if he will come on board. So it'll have such a wide appeal and make an awful lot of money.
Beyoncé headlines London's leg of a series of shows to raise cash for Haiti later. That's the latest. I'm Ben Biddulph.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Had a funny turn? Perhaps your speech was slurred or you couldn't pick up your cup of tea? You may well have had a mini stroke, also called a TIA. Mini strokes are an early warning sign. Spotting the signs of a mini stroke early and getting treatment can significantly reduce the risk of a full-blown stroke. Like a stroke, a mini stroke happens when the flow of blood to the brain is blocked by a small clot. But unlike a full stroke, with a mini stroke you'll often feel much better within a few hours. Don't ignore them. If you think you may have had a mini stroke in the past, talk to your GP. Strokes happen to people we care about. Act fast. Brought to you by NHS Bristol. Bristol Community FM 93.2.
We'll be right back. Wonderful stuff. I hope they got your foot tapping, folks. That is the sound of Sarah Savoy and the Francadians. If you like the sound of that and would like to hear a little bit more, I warn you, they're playing all weekend at the Gloucester Cajun and Zydeco Festival up in Gloucester, on running all of this weekend. If, however, you don't fancy the trip up the M5 to Gloucester, you can catch them here in Bristol at St. George's at 3 p.m. That's on Sunday. Now then, if you like your music of a slightly more British folk tilt, then tomorrow night is definitely the evening to get to the Colston Hall, because the legendary voices of Martin Carthy, Eliza Carthy and Chris Wood are fronting the Imagined Village, which is a cross-contaminated, cross-fertilised world music operation they've got up and running with some of the elements of the Afro-Celtic sound system and a few others. Even Billy Bragg is alleged to have doffed his hat at this one. And that's at the Colston Hall tomorrow night, the Imagined Village. These gigs will, of course, cost you money. I'm going to go directly now into what you can do for absolutely free. I've even done some research for you this week. On the 27th of January, which is next Wednesday, there's a Holocaust Memorial Day, and the Legacy of Hope is being explored at Bristol Cathedral. This is a free event. I'm going to give you a little bit on what Nick at the Perian Centre has sent to me about this. The Legacy of Hope is a 45-minute soundscape designed to engage all comers of every faith or none. At its heart are two pieces by the prolific Bath-based composer Howard Davidson. These have been written specifically for the acoustics and architecture of Bristol Cathedral, one of the finest hall churches anywhere in the world. The Guests is a new composition. It's Howard's setting of a Leonard Cohen poem for soprano voice and clarinet septet. The lyric starts, "One by one the guests arrive, the guests are coming through, the open-hearted many, the broken-hearted few." The second piece is an arrangement of the Abyss of Birds movement from Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time, which was written by Messiaen while he was interned in a prisoner of war camp. Howard has taken the piece, written in the grim surroundings of the German prisoner of war camp, and arranged it for 10 clarinets. In this unique performance, the 10 players are spaced throughout the cathedral, some of them hidden and unseen, and all 10 perform as soloists, like songbirds that they represent. The Legacy of Hope also features music from Bristol Cathedral choristers and the cantor Robert Hurst. There we go. It's a free event. It takes place at 5:15 p.m. on Wednesday the 27th of January at Bristol Cathedral College Green, lasting 45 minutes. The purpose of Holocaust Memorial Day is to transform events of a tragic scale and horror into a source of hope, to turn the scars of the past into a source of growth and understanding. These events are all free. Remember that, folks, free, and should be a surprisingly positive experience. More details, you can find them at hmd.org.uk. And finally, before I leave this, earlier that day, from 1 to 2 p.m. on Wednesday the 27th of January, there is a commemorative event at the University of Bristol Multi-Faith Chaplaincy on No. 1 Woodland Road for members of the public as well as staff and students. On the Sunday before, which is 2 days' time, from 6 to 6:30 p.m, there is a Holocaust Memorial Day meditation in St. Paul's Church, St. Paul's Road in Clifton. Listen out to for the world premiere of a new song by Jewish-Muslim hip-hop duo Lines of Faith. Taking visitor comments from last May's Anne Frank and You exhibition, they've been working with international singer-songwriter Darude Warrensby on a song designed to challenge and heal prejudice. If you would like further details on that, please get yourselves along to shalomshalom.org.uk. Now then, that's from Nick Thomas at the Perian Centre. Thank you for that, Nick. DMAC UK, it's Dance Music and Arts Collective. They're having their launch party this evening. At Stokes Croft, at Hamilton House in Stokes Croft. It starts at 7:30, and there are free taster workshops of the kind of work that they do from 11 a.m. till 6 p.m. tomorrow. As I said, this is Stokes Croft, Hamilton House in Stokes Croft. All welcome to come and join us at the launch party of a brand new studios on the evening of Friday, 22nd of January, with Rhythm Release Dance Off. The following day, Saturday the 23rd, we will be hosting free taster sessions in all the disciplines we offered, followed by an evening of astounding performances for some of the funkiest people in Bristol, before we party off into the small hours. It's all happening at once, so don't miss out. And this is for everybody who loves dance. So that's at Hamilton House in Stokes Croft. They cover all ranges of dance down there, hip-hop, classic, you know, all that sort of stuff, ballet, whatever you like, street dance. Now then, I'm going to stay in Stokes Croft for a little while. There's a new art cafe opening in Stokes Croft, and they are premiering a set of works on Thursday evening next week. between 6 and 8 p.m. That's by invitation only. However, from 11 a.m. the following morning, 7 a.m., I beg your pardon, 7 a.m. till 11 p.m. every day, the Arts House will be open to the public. You can buy a cup of tea and you can go and see the work of Jamie Hewlett. We would love to see you at the preview night of Watercolours, Underwater Colours, by groundbreaking and internationally renowned artist Jamie Hewlett. He has done the album artwork for Gorillaz Monkey and Journey to the West. In late 2009, Jamie travelled to Bangladesh with Oxfam to see how climate change is already costing lives. These striking watercolours document his response to the experience. They are also being sold as limited edition prints to raise money for Oxfam's River Basin programme. It's also the grand opening of the Art House. The Arts House, I beg your pardon, the newest addition to the vibrant community that is Stokes Croft, offering a cafe, bar, cinema and live music venue, as well as a beautiful gallery space. We will be open from 7am till 11pm every day. So that's from next Friday onwards. You can go and do that for free. Go and see Jamie Hewlett's watercolours and buy some. It's all for a good cause. Now, at Shop this weekend on the Christmas Steps, there is a shop called Shop on the Christmas Steps. This is a free event from noon on Saturday, that's tomorrow, until noon on Sunday. And I like the sound of this. Smooth comic creator Simon Morton and Shop think that drawing should be a democratic, fun and all about self-expression. Not stuffy, exclusionary or about accuracy. Who cares whether your bowl of fruit looks like a bowl of fruit? We say everyone can draw. I agree with that. Come along and support us by drawing for just 1 minute or the whole 24 hours. Work created during the challenge will be displayed in the shop for the following week. And that is a 24-hour draw-a-thon. Which I think is very, very good fun. It starts at noon tomorrow, it runs till noon on Sunday at Shop on Park Street. Now, another free event I need to warn you about, which is rather jolly. Of course, Tony's going to start having kittens now if I stay in his studio for too long. At the old fire station, the makers of Skins, you may be aware of the movie show Skins on telly, which is all shot in and around Bristol. Now, the makers of Skins have taken control of the old fire station right in the centre of town. You may wish to confirm admission details with the event organiser before travelling. Next Friday night, at the 29th of January, at 10pm at the Bridewell Old Fire Station, formerly Café Blue in Bristol, there is a night of entertainment. And there's it's in association with Blowpop. There's an awful lot of groups, local acts, local things, and it's free. It's, I would say, primarily for a youth audience. And if you would like tickets for that, please go to e4.com/skins/skinshouse introduction HTML. There you go. A night of entertainment in aid of Temwa. This is at the Bristol Folk House tonight. If you would like more information, then log on to www.myspace.com Temwa Charity. It's £6 on the, £8 on the door, £6 advance. Tickets are available from the Bristol Folk, the Bristol Ticket Shop. Sorry, I beg your pardon. It's at the Folk House, and this is entitled Folk Tales and Magic. Some of Bristol's finest folk musicians, storytellers and magicians gather for an evening of fine entertainment, all in aid of a wonderful cause. The Folk House, Bristol Park Street, tonight. This will be a magical evening of sensory nourishment that will uplift and enlighten, featuring Rachel Dadd, Stanton Delaplane, who we like very, very much on this play, on this show. Kieran the Mighty, he's a magician. Martin Mosley, Spendthrift, Jess Lewin, Roving Blades and Emigre. It's all hosted by Martin Mosley, who will be telling some folk tales. There is a gift stall and amazing raffles and a night of prizes from the Bristol Relaxation Centre, the Bristol Packet Boat Company, Lush and many more. Tomorrow night, if you prefer something a little more folk-based, then get yourselves along there, because Gavin Thorpe, who's a Bristol-based singer-songwriter, boasting a stunning voice and arsenal of cheeky on stage aside, and looks to match. So they say. I don't know. I can't vouch for that myself. I haven't seen him as yet. So that's the free. That's not quite free at the Folk House, but it's still a good fun thing to do. Now, I'm going to stick with this presently, because if you get yourselves up to the Water Tower on the Downs on Sunday, the Bristol Cycling Campaign Club are going on a bicycle ride and wassail trail. They recommend that you bring red wine and ginger cake, and it's quite a fun thing. There are two pub stops and you're heading off to Honeycomb Farm, someplace in the Mendips, I believe. It's suitable for beginners. I would strongly recommend, having done a bit of bicycling myself, that you wear some waterproof gear. If, however, you like music prefer music to cycling around the place, you can get yourselves along this evening to the Croft. Go and see Pizzali, who is fronted by our very favourite Blythe Pepino. We love her very much. Slapstick, of course, is on all weekend. Now, at the Bristol Old Vic for the next 10 days, it started on the 20th and it's running until the 30th. It's Bristol Ferment. This is a very good opportunity for all of you to go along and see some work in, some dramatic work in construction, I suppose, is the best way to do it. There's a number of script and hand readings and rehearsed performances and that sort of stuff. It's not like going to a play. There won't be any scenery or costumes or any of that sort of stuff. It's just script and hand readings of works in progress. But certainly the Sharon Clark, who's the woman down there, the writing mentor at the Bristol Old Vic, does a phenomenal job, and I can certainly vouch for some of the work that's come through in the last 18 months or so. So it's well worth getting along to see how that process is generating. Now, Tony is screaming at me, so I'm going to whiz. Get yourselves along to the RWA at the top of Queen's Road. It is Urban Evolution by Anne Desmet, and then there is Creating Paper is the other feature that's going on up there. I spoke to you briefly about what's going on at the Colston Hall. Do not miss whatever the hell you're doing. Next Wednesday evening, Vladimir Ashkenazy is conducting Stephen Ischlis in the Elgar Cello Concerto, and Ashkenazy is a man of advancing years, probably one of the four cornerstones of classical music in the 20th century. He will not be coming back to Bristol in a hurry. This is your very, very last chance to see him here, so go along to that. Slapstick, loads and loads of fun stuff. I'm very much looking forward on Sunday to going along to Jester's, because they're having a Neil Innes-based day. Neil Innes, as we all know and love from the Bonzo Dog Dude band, founded the Ruttles. He invented a whole new genre of English ruttling, as he does. If you like drama slightly more for the juniors, get yourselves along from tomorrow onwards to the Redgrave Theatre in Clifton, because the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School are making a presentation of The Tempest. It has been adapted and directed by Toby Hulse. It's running for 1 week, and it runs at 10:30 a.m. in the morning, which is great. It's suitable for anyone over 5 years old, they say. Now, back to some free stuff. Down at the Arnold Feeney are perpetually running lots and lots of free things. This is the middle of their craftivism programming. There is a Labour Behind the Label workshop next Wednesday at 2 p.m. All of this week, there has been an installation of British wrestling legends in the Colston Hall foyer, which is quite funny, and also the BSL tour is coming to the craftivism exhibition. It's being led by artist Matt Jenkins and interpreted by Sarah Barefoot. That's next Saturday at 3 p.m. Now, you have one more day to see Jack and the Beanstalk as performed by the Sodbury Players. That's at the Chipping Sodbury Town Hall. Get yourselves along to that one. Free writing workshops in Westbury-on-Trim next Tuesday evening at the Church of England School in Westbury-on-Trim from 7 till 9 p.m. Facilitated by Sheila Hannan of the Shoal Strength Theatre Company, and this is all to do with trading local. These are pieces, it is mainly for people from Westbury-on-Trim. The idea is that you write a piece of drama, a monologue, for which lasts about 10 minutes, and then it's going to be performed in April by Shoal Strength Theatre Company in the shops of Westbury-on-Trim. It's a very, very exciting project. As I said, Sarah Savoy and the Francadians are playing in St. George's on Sunday afternoon. However, on Saturday night, tomorrow night, 7:30 p.m. Tom Gautran takes the baton for the second of his installations of the Brahms symphony cycle. It's symphony number 2 tomorrow night. I'm delighted to say Madeline Ridd is coming along to play the Dvorak Cello Concerto in B minor also. I have to say, these guys are very, very exciting. It's difficult to make Brahms sound fun, but the Bristol Classical, certainly under the leadership of Tom Gautran, do it very, very well indeed. And finally, if you feel you haven't been scared enough by environmental issues, flooding, global warming, terrorism, X, Y, or Z catastrophe, and of course living in the perpetual shadow of CCTV, that is Britain in the 21st century, then why don't you try something a little more 19th century? Get yourselves down to the Brewery Theatre in North Street in Bedminster for an evening of M.R. James' Ghost Stories. It's a gothic masterpiece presented spectacularly well by Robert Lloyd Parry. He's been touring the show of Ghost Stories since 2006. Obviously, the content changes from time to time, but M.R. James is very much in the Edgar Allan Poe vein. I am hoping to have a word with Mr. Parry myself on my show, the Bristol Arts Show, between 10 a.m. and midday tomorrow on BCFM 93.2. I would love for you to join me for that. If you can't make it, then I'm afraid you're missing out. What more can I say? However, Do get yourselves along to the brewery. It promises to be a humdinger. With that, I'm going to play you out now. This is Bellowhead. They're coming to Bristol in about 10 days' time as part of the winter song season at the Bristol Old Vic. Enjoy it.
The baker I must bring him in. Judge Tuffin's a loaf, and he'll think it's no sin. When he do bring it in, it's no bigger than the abyss. And the top of the loaf is popped off with the yeast. And honesty is all out of fashion. These are the rings of the times, times before. These are the rings of the times. Sure, I must bring him in. He judges fourpence a pound, and he'll think it's no sin. Sets his hand on the scale weight and makes it go down. He'll swear it's good weight when it wants on the pound. And honesty is all fashioned. These are the rings of the times, times, my boys. These are the rings of the skimps on our clothes, and the shoemaker who pinches our toes. So our bells go empty, our bank's eyes go bare. It's no wonder we reason to curse and to swear. That honesty is all out of fashion. These are the rings of the times, times, my boys. These are the rings of the times.
Folks, that is the sound of Bellowhead, who you can see at the Bristol Old Vic, a slightly unusual location for them. That's a track of theirs called The Rigs of the Time. You can go along and see them as part of Songs of the Winter, I think, is the programme. And that's in about 2 weeks' time. I would now like to welcome back into their own studio Tony Gosling and Martin.
And Martin Summers, the Lady Gaga fan. I think he would rather have heard Lady Gaga than what we just heard.
I quite like Bellowhead, actually.
Yeah, well, he did pick him, you know. He said, oh, that's Bellowhead you're playing. So, fair play to you for that. I must say, until this week, I was less than familiar with their canon.
Yeah, they're a sort of folk rock band, aren't they? They've got lots of folky roots.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, I mean, you two are gentlemen of slightly more advanced years than I am. Have you heard of Martin and Eliza Carthy?
Of course.
Who are doing...
Eliza Carthy, definitely. I don't know who
big, well, there's big gig in Colston Hall tomorrow night with their new outfit, which is the Imagined Village. So that might be worth getting along to.
Ah, but is it... How expensive is it?
It's pricey. I think it's about 16 quid. So that's hardly recession-busting pricing, I would say. Speaking of recessions, I gather we're talking about banks for the next few minutes.
Well, yes. It's Goldman Sachs, particularly. It's one of the stories we didn't have a chance to cover in the last week, because we do talk about Goldman Sachs quite a lot. So most of the headlines I noticed over the last day or so to do with Goldman Sachs. Do you want to just start, Martin, by explaining what Goldman Sachs is? It's an investment bank. It's not a high street bank.
Yeah, although they've managed to kid the public in the US that they are a bank, and therefore are entitled to TARP bailout money. But of course you can't actually, as an ordinary punter, put any money in that bank or take any money out. It's a bit of a scam, really. They're a classic example of the sort of people that shouldn't have been bailed out but have been.
So what is an investment bank and what makes it different to a high street bank?
Investment banks basically take bets and risks and so on, and the Glass-Steagall Act, which was brought in the Roosevelt administration in the 30s in the US, separated investment banking from retail banking precisely because you don't want to run risk ordinary people's savings and all the risky things that investment banks do. And in 1999, the Clinton administration, under a very, very strong pressure from Wall Street, basically got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act, which allowed investment banks and retail banks to mix themselves up. And there was a very good reason why they were separated. They were separated in the 30s to prevent exactly the kind of mess that's now subsequently developed. And so, you know, Obama's talking about re-regulating the banking system yesterday. I mean, one of the things he really needs to look at is bringing Glass-Steagall back in so that you separate risky investment banking from boring retail banking.
But, Martin, was the Glass-Steagall legislation actually abolished, or was it? Did they just stop policing it in the 80s?
No, they abolished that actual act.
Oh, okay.
But what Eliot Spitzer was saying, who was the Attorney General for New York State, and he was like the kind of guy who was supposed to regulate Wall Street, mm-hmm. He was saying that even with the weaker rules that have been coming in for years, because they've been gradually deregulating, they're always asking for a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. But he said even the weak rules that now exist have not been enforced. So there is a question of enforcement there. Mm-hmm. The rules that are on the statute book haven't been enforced, and the rules themselves have been weakened. And I think we've got to... I mean, there were very good reasons for those rules in the first place. It's like if you were playing hurling and you said, OK, well, let's just get rid of the rule where you can't hit them with the sticks. And it starts to become a bit messy. And perhaps we'd better go back to the rule where you can't just hit them with the sticks. You know, you have to hit the ball instead, you know.
Mm. Now, I know they're based on Wall Street, but, I mean, to what extent do Goldman Sachs have a big presence in the City of London and other European cities?
Well, they're based in...
Even in Tokyo.
Or they're based in all... They've got branches in all the major financial centres. That many people in the US think that they've basically captured the US government. I mean, Goldman Sachs' ex-employees now run the whole regulatory structure and are packed inside the Obama administration and the Bush administration. So they've become a very, very powerful force. And of course, they've paid themselves extra money in this article, or possibly paid themselves extra bonuses, but they've managed to go around by paying themselves extra money. But of course, it's all based on the fact that they are supposedly profitable. Mm-hmm. But all of these banks are only profitable if we count all the toxic assets on their books at full book value. And of course, that's precisely the point. Most of this stuff is worth nothing. And if you actually valued it at nothing, they wouldn't be making any profits at all, and therefore no bonuses, no pay increases.
But just a minute, at Companies House and places like that, and the Inland Revenue, go through these books with a fine tooth comb.
No, they don't. This is one of the problems. The Enron showed the way, which is you keep not just one set of books, but seven or eight different sets of books, and you put most of the stuff where you're losing money in the off the books books that nobody gets to look at. And that's one of the problems, is accounting fraud. Not just the rules not being strong enough, but the rules not being enforced. A lot of this is blatantly fraudulent. We're not just talking about should we give money to Goldman Sachs. Some people at the head of Goldman Sachs should probably be in prison, but they're not. Eliot Spitzer, as I mentioned a minute ago, he was removed as Attorney General of New York because he was caught having sex with a high-class prostitute, and that was apparently enough to remove him. Perhaps he shouldn't have been doing that, but I think the reason he was removed was because he was actually trying to enforce the law. And if you look him up on the internet, you'll see that he is sitting in the corner saying, look, this is what I tell people, they're not enforcing the law, they should be enforcing it.
They're getting away with it.
They're getting away with it.
This story, though, I was quite impressed, actually, the way Goldman Sachs managed to spin it, because if you look at all the most of the headlines to do with this announcement, I think it's a quarterly profit announcement, and also they're also talking about how much they're reimbursing their directors and staff, is that almost every single story was saying Goldman Sachs cut their bonuses. But then when you actually look at one or two of the headlines, for example, on the front page of today's Daily Mail, you'll see that they actually they're taking away with one hand and giving with the other, and they've given themselves actually 57% pay rises. So the bonuses have been cut, but the actual statutory pay, annual pay, has gone way up. I mean, anyone listening to this who got a 57% pay rise would be rather chuffed.
57% pay rise on £3 million a year minimum, you know. It's 57% of millions, isn't it?
It's not just the directors. I mean, it goes all the way across. It filters all the way down through this company, because I gather you can quote me as being incorrect about this, but I heard a lovely one on Moneybox the other day. The average employee salary for 2009, a very, very bad year for Goldman Sachs by all accounts, was over $350,000. So for that kind of money, I'd be quite happy to be bad at banking.
Isn't it lucky that we've got a Labour government that represents ordinary working people so that they can stop this happening?
No, absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you.
Come on, Martin, you're a Labour Party.
Well, I think the problem is that politics, particularly in the US, Obama is very much supported by Wall Street, so he finds it very difficult to discipline them, because in many ways he's answerable to the electorate. But also, if you want to go anywhere in US politics, you need money, and that means Wall Street.
I have to say, Martin, you're diverting quite well here, but really, the City of London has had a free ride for the last 12 years under Gordon Brown's stewardship.
They have indeed.
As Chancellor.
Didn't they invent New Labour? The City invented New Labour.
Yes, if you remember the prawn cocktail offensive, I don't know if people remember this. That's when John Smith went round to the City of London before, it wasn't even the 93 election, was it? It was 93 election before the 90, it was 93 election, basically making them all happy that Labour wasn't going to do anything to upset their party. And I think a lot of the problems we've got now is that historical surrender of the pass. I mean, basically, we should have told them years ago that you know, we're going to regulate you, and we haven't been doing that, and I think, therefore, we're going to take the punishment we deserve for that.
And I see Fred Goodwin this week. Fred the Shred has been appointed to a new job as a consultant for a set of Edinburgh architects, on a huge salary for some reason.
Well, he's a very talented man. If you can get away with what he's got away with, then you'd, you know, I'd recruit him for the Italian job any day.
Yes, 21st century Dick Turpin, isn't he? Except he forgets to give his ill-gotten gains to the poor.
Yes, well, Dick Turpin didn't give his ill-gotten gains to the poor either. It was Robin Hood.
Well, so I think it's a case, do you think, Martin, of regulatory capture? This is something that you quite often talk about on the show here. The idea that a business and a cartel of businesses within a particular, working in a particular area, can get so powerful that they actually start to take over the whole regulatory mechanism of that area.
Yeah, and there's a deliberate attempt to make everything they're doing so complicated that only they can understand it, so only they can regulate it.
Ah, but you understand it, don't you?
No, I don't understand it. Nor do the managers of the banks. There's a lot of what the derivatives and special investment vehicles, investment vehicles that have been created, the top managers don't understand what their technicians are doing. But as long as they're making money, they don't ask questions. And there's an old adage that if something looks too good to be true, it usually is. And you don't need a mathematical genius to work that one out. If you're getting a higher level of return from an Icelandic bank, that's because there's more of a chance that it might go bust.
The one thing I would say, I'm not defending Goldman Sachs by any stretch, but there was one desk of traders who hedged about 18 months
ago. That's a very good question. I'll come to that.
Well, there was just two guys, and they sat, as we three are, around quite a small desk, and they thought, did a little bit of beard stroking. This isn't looking good. I foresee dark clouds in the future. They approached their boss and said, could we please have $1 billion to short sell the market? Well, and these two guys absolutely called it perfectly.
Yes, and you know what's going on there, and there's a question about this. Elliot Spitzer was saying that this is fraudulent, because what you're doing, on one hand, Goldman Sachs is selling investors, why don't you buy this subprime garbage? It's all good, high-quality stuff. Meanwhile, the real traders are betting against that. So Goldman Sachs is official traders, where you, if you phoned up Goldman Sachs to place a bet, they would place the bet and say, oh yes, this is a good bet. Meanwhile, the top of the bank is betting against their own traders. And that's because they know the market is going to collapse, because that's what happens with these kind of markets.
This is fraudulent insider trading.
It's fraudulent insider trading with knowledge, and there's a question whether these people should in fact be going to prison rather than being given a pat on the back.
In the city, they call it short selling. And I know that when it got very bad, when Lehman Brothers collapsed, they steamrolled through, Ben Bernanke steamrolled through a ban on short selling for, I think it was 45-day period or 60-day period.
Yes, well, that was through, that, you see, what's interesting about Lehman Brothers being allowed to go down and then Goldman Sachs being rescued is that what's now happening is that it's not a market deciding who gets rescued and who doesn't. It's a political decision, and Goldman Sachs have got the political clout to be rescued and Lehman Brothers haven't. So the decision to do one thing or the other is, in fact, not being made on one market criteria at all. It's a question of who's got the ear of the king. And this is you know, money is no longer money. It's a political decision whether banks are allowed to fail or stand. And Goldman Sachs have now become the biggest bank in the world. They're taking massive amounts of taxpayers' money, and they're in a position to get rid of their rivals by making sure that they don't get any of the money. And the TARP money in the US, we're not even allowed to know what's happened to it. It's all commercially confidential. Could you believe it? $800 billion has been spent, but nobody in Congress or the Senate is allowed to know what the money's been spent on, because that's commercially confidential. It's ridiculous. I mean, if PCFM gets an extra packet of pens or paper clips, they have to account for it. But $800 billion, we don't have to tell you what we've done with it. It's extraordinary.
Let's just have a look at some of these figures. Goldman Sachs said it had net profit of $4,787 billion in the fourth quarter. Is that four trillion profit? For the full year, it posted net profit of $12,192 billion.
That's because they're getting all of this free money from the Federal Reserve at 0% interest, and they just go and chuck it at the market on speculative trades and make money on it. It's money for old rope. And don't forget that when they say they're making a profit, they're still counting all their toxic assets at full value. And if you were to value them at zero, which is what they're really worth, they're bust. They're still bust.
So if Goldman Sachs are a naughty investment bank, a bad investment bank, are there some good ones around?
No. Frankly, no. The one thing about Goldman Sachs is they are the most successful investment bank. I alluded earlier to the two chaps sat around the desk shorting the entire stock market before the house of cards fell down. Goldman actually didn't really need to take too much TARP money. They just took it for the
they're
sake implicit, of saving
they're
face.
Implicitly supported by the government's backing of the whole system, because of their counter trades at AIG and Lehman were all covered.
Yes,
yeah?
Absolutely. But the other banks, I mean, the TARP money was really to stop Bank of America going bad, because there was this whole line with AIG and Bank of America, they were too big to go bust. It actually wasn't Obama, it was Bernanke and his successor, whose name now escapes me, the baldy guy, stepped in and said, we can't allow this to happen because it will actually cripple the US economy because there was so much tied in.
It's becoming clear that this is what I called earlier a banker's ramp. They knew very well what they were doing was blowing bubbles and bursting them. That's what you do. You blow a bubble, then you burst it, and you short it at the end, mm-hmm. So all the suckers pick up the tab for you. And the idea that any of these banks are somehow independent of government intervention is simply specious. I mean, they're all basically dependent upon the backing that the entire system has been given. These banks which have been bailed out, they owe money to Goldman Sachs, so they've been able to pay Goldman Sachs. So Goldman Sachs may not have taken any money directly, but indirectly, the whole system has been propped up. And if we're going to prop up the system, and probably we had to because there was no other option, that's when you say, right, you've smashed the car up, you're going to be grounded. You know, we are now going to bring in various regulations about what you do. But what we're trying to do is, by quantitative easing and TARP money and so on, is restart the bubble. And it's just not going to work. And even if it did work, it wouldn't be the right way to go. And there's no, you know, we've got to call a spade here. The banking system is broke, and we've got to actually fix it by changing it completely, not just trying to resurrect it in its old form.
So do you think that Alistair Darling and Gordon Brown have got their heads around this, or have they had the wool pulled over their eyes? What's going on?
I think there's been a group think about all of this, that it was all okay and somehow it was going to be all right. And they've all bought into it, so none of them come out of it looking very good.
And do you think they'll turn things around? down by election time and use this to win votes by understanding what's going on and dealing with this?
Well, I have to say, considering Alistair Darling is supposed to be steering the ship through the worst recession in living memory, bearing in mind Gordon Brown made a huge song and dance about the fact that there are 7,000 people less on the live register this week than there were this time last month, Alistair Darling has been amazingly mute throughout this whole catastrophe. He came out in early doors and said, yeah, this is very bad, and then he published his budget and said, yes, well, we're going to have to tighten our belts. I noticed that petrol has gone back up to about £1.10 again. Last time that happened, the truck drivers were barricading the motorways, and it just seems that we've been beaten into submission with this avalanche of dour, dreadful news, and actually, I don't really see anybody doing a huge amount of work. Mervyn King spoke at Exeter University during the week, the governor of the Bank of England, and he said that it isn't going to get better for a long, long time to come. Bearing in mind, the quantitative easing is still going on. This is the printing of fresh money, just like Mugabe does, because he's run out of funds. So you're spending, you know, hyperinflation in Weimar Germany in the 1930s with a whole wheelbarrow worth of...
This quantitative easing has been going on for a long time now, and we haven't had hyperinflation.
Now, the question of whether it'll cause inflation is an interesting one. The jury's out on this, because the deflationary effect of all of these toxic assets is bigger than the quantitative easing. So the quantitative easing is printing money to keep buying these toxic assets, and it won't turn into inflation or even hyperinflation until... there are two schools of thought on this. I mean, people I admire see hyperinflation in the works, and others see deflation. I think what may happen in the end is we're going to get both hyperinflation and deflation, which will be very, very scary if that's how it transpired. And as I've said previously on previous programmes, if I were you, I wouldn't start from here.
Well,
that's not very helpful, is it?
No.
Interest rates are still at 0.5%, which is great. Central bank lending is at 0.5%. That is entirely unsustainable. And if you cast your mind back 5 or 6 years, when Alan Greenspan was in charge of the Fed in the US, he kept inflation lending at 1% for an awfully long time, over 2.5 years, I think, which is what fueled this subprime issue in the first place. Interest rates do have to go back up, I'm afraid. You will start finding it in your pocket that your mortgage repayments are no longer £200 a month.
If we're going to put interest rates back up, and we may have to, then you've got to increase fiscal spending on the other side to balance that, because otherwise the economy will go into a tailspin. The danger is that we're running out of levers to pull, either interest rate levers or quantitative easing levers or fiscal levers. And at that point, you're really looking at a potential serious crash. I mean, the stuff I've seen on the television, they were saying that when at the height of the crisis this time last year, we were looking at the possibility of all banks closing their doors and turning around to people queuing up outside and saying, well, all that money you had in the bank, we've lost it. That's how close we came.
But I don't understand how banks can do that. In fact, I don't think they can if they're honest bankers, because we know for a fact
things can
that
go
banks, what banks have the right to do is make money up out of nowhere and then lend it out at interest. Now, if I had the right to make money up out of nowhere and then lend it out at interest, I don't see how I could ever go bust, because each year
well, you
I'm
don't
to make a load of new money out.
You don't for years and years and years until you hit the problem that we've just hit. I mean, that's exactly what's been happening. They've been expanding loans and expanding the money supply. The government's lost control of the money supply years ago. I mean, this whole idea that the government controls the money supply is just laughable.
I mean, when I first heard that this whole thing about banks making up money out of nowhere and then lending it out of interest, I actually went to the one of the mortgage advisors at the Co-op Bank here in Bristol and said, is it true this what banks do? They actually make money up out of nowhere, then lend it in interest. And he sort of looked at the floor and said, well, yes, actually, that is.
Well, John Kenneth Galbraith, the American great American economist, he said the mechanism by which banks make money is so simple that it boggles the mind. You know, it's actually so straightforward.
Isn't it?
It's basically being allowed to be a bank is being allowed to create money, and that's why they have to be regulated.
So it basically goes like this. It sort of goes... and an extra zero appears on the end of their account.
Pretty much. That's the size of it. And bear in mind, if
how can they fail? I don't understand.
Because they blow up bubbles, which they make money on, and then they crash the bubbles and they walk away with the loot and we're left with the mess. I mean, that's how you make money. It's not difficult to make money if you've got that kind of power, but whether you make the economy run is another matter.
So anyway, we've got some more to cover before the end of the show. Go on, Billy, you were going to say
something? Well, I was just going to say, 700 years ago, according to Dante, you would have ended up in the fourth circle of hell for the sin of usury.
Indeed.
Well, maybe that's where they will end.
I noticed that limbo was abolished by the Pope not long ago. Did you see that? It's like a red bus. It's been there for years, and he's getting used to limbo, and then limbo has been abolished. Pope Benedict got rid of limbo.
Okay, thanks both of you. Thousands of US soldiers have returned to the United States and are speaking out after their tours of duty in Iraq. They formed a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War, and we'll be hearing now what some of them have to say. First of all, Mike Preisner.
And I tried hard to be proud of my service, but all I could feel was shame. And racism could no longer mask the reality of the occupation. These were people, these were human beings. I've since been plagued by guilt anytime I see an elderly man, like the one who couldn't walk, who we rolled onto a stretcher and told the Iraqi police to take him away. I feel guilt anytime I see a mother with her children, like the one who cried hysterically and screamed that we are worse than Saddam as we forced her from her home. I feel guilt anytime I see a young girl, like the one I grabbed by the arm and dragged into the street. We were told we were fighting terrorists. The real terrorist was me, and the real terrorism is this occupation. Racism within the military has long been an important tool to justify the destruction and occupation of another country. It has long been used to justify the killing, subjugation, and torture of another people. Racism is a vital weapon employed by this government. It is more important weapon than a rifle, a tank, a bomber, or a battleship. It is more destructive than an artillery shell, or a bunker buster, or a Tomahawk missile. While those weapons are created and owned by this government, they are harmless without people willing to use them. Those who send us to war do not have to pull a trigger or lob a mortar round. They do not have to fight the war, they merely have to sell the war. They need a public who is willing to send their soldiers into harm's way. They need soldiers who are willing to kill and be killed without question. They can spend millions on a single bomb, but that bomb only becomes a weapon when the ranks of the military are willing to follow orders to use it. They can send every last soldier anywhere on earth, but there will only be a war if soldiers are willing to fight. And the ruling class, the billionaires who profit from human suffering, care only about expanding their wealth, controlling the world economy. Understand that their power lies only in their ability to convince us that war, oppression, and exploitation is in our interest. They understand that their wealth is dependent on their ability to convince the working class to die to control the market of another country. And convincing us to kill and die is based on their ability to make us think that we are somehow superior. Soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen have nothing to gain from this occupation. The vast majority of people living in the U.S. have nothing to gain from this occupation. In fact, not only do we have nothing to gain, but we suffer more because of it. We lose limbs, endure trauma, and give our lives. Our families have to watch flag-draped coffins lowered into the earth. Millions in this country without health care, jobs, or access to education must watch this government squander over $450 million a day on this occupation.
That's Mike Preisner. He's one of the members of the group in the US called IVAW, which stands for Iraq Veterans Against the War. Now, Martin, have you come across this group? What do you know about
them? Yeah, I've come across them before. I read a book which they put together with a lot of very harrowing accounts of what people have been through. You know, I mean, you can fool some of the people some of the time and all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. And, you know, many soldiers who've seen these sad things have been changed by the experience.
I mean, one of the things I can remember when the Iraq invasion first happened was a report back, I think it was, must have been a live report, because I would imagine that if it had been said, it would have been edited out if it was a pre-recorded report, which was one of the soldiers actually, when he was asked a question, said, well, whatever you do, don't believe what you see on the television. And I thought at the time, gosh, this is all live, isn't it? This guy's actually, a soldier, has actually stepped up to the camera and said this.
Well, good for him. On this topic, in actual fact, this next Friday, at 10 a.m. in Bulford Army Base in Wiltshire, Lance Corporal Joe Glenson is going to start his court-martial for refusing to fight in Afghanistan. And I think some people from Bristol are intending to go. Apparently the court is an open court, and I think some people from Bristol are intending to go and show their support for Joe next Friday in the courtroom.
Well, in the meantime, we're going to hear now from the president of Iraq Veterans Against the War, Josh Simpson, and here he is speaking on Venezuelan television.
seguimos de conversar con Josh Simpson, quien es presidente de la organización Veteranos de Irak contra la Guerra en el Fuerte Lewis. Welcome you. Gracias por acompañarnos, Carmelo Velázquez, también ayudarnos.
You decided to go to Iraq.
It's not like I really decided to go to Iraq. I joined the army prior to 9/11. When 9/11 happened, I was actually in basic training, and from that moment, you know, basically I knew I was going to go to war. I kind of assumed it would be Afghanistan. But fortunately, it was a few years till I actually got deployed because my unit was in training. But when I eventually did get deployed, it was to Iraq. And at that point, I was still against the war, but not in the same way that I am today. You know, I thought the war was wrong. But at the same time, at that point, you know, when I was in the military, I didn't know of anyone resisting deployment to Iraq. So, you know, I went to Iraq as I was told. And while I was there, I saw lots of things that changed my opinion on the war dramatically. A lot of things I saw there was due to the fact that my job, most of the time, the job I did in the military was in Iraq was I was interrogating Iraqis. And the key word is Iraqis, not insurgents. It was probably about 95% of the people I interrogated in Iraq had nothing to do with the insurgency. They were just working people like anyone else, and they were basically just caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it seems like today, or at least when I was in Iraq, that the U.S. military judges its success in Iraq by how many people it can detain and send to prison. The interrogations that I performed were actually pretty by the book, and we actually followed the laws for the most part. You know, I did see soldiers occasionally hit detainees, but not too terribly. But the thing that I did see that was really terrible was the fact that the U.S. military would send, you know, detainees to the Iraqi National Guard, Iraqi police. Okay, basically, you know, the Iraqi government in Iraq is just a puppet of the United States. And basically what they would do is they would, you know, the U.S., my unit at least, wouldn't torture detainees, but they would send them off to the Iraqi military to torture them. And this is a huge change in my thinking, because right then and there I realized that not only is torture immoral, it's also really ineffective for gathering information. Because I would get huge lists of confessions that the Iraqi military would give me from people that would confess to doing crimes there's no way they possibly could have committed. They'd be confessing to every terrorist attack that was ever committed in Iraq.
And that was
the fact that they were tortured and they'd say anything.
They continue to
apply. I usually didn't see the torture. I would see the after effects of the torture. The detainee come in with lashes all over his body, bruises all over their body, to the point where there wouldn't be an inch of flesh that was unmarked. And the only thing I could really use to explain what it looked like to me was photos from my American history textbooks of the way slaves were beaten would look.
Now, Martin, do you think there's a certain amount of disloyalty here amongst the soldiers? Because it sounds to me as if, you know, if you're involved in a conflict like that, maybe, you know, it's your duty bound not to speak out.
On the contrary, professional soldiers, are trained in human rights these days, and in actual fact, they're duty-bound to speak out.
But what he said there, of course, is that they weren't actually doing the torture themselves, his unit, but what they were doing was handing people over to the Iraqi police and the Iraqi forces to do the torturing.
Yep, and of course there's an awful lot of that been going on. I mean, Guantanamo is the tip of an iceberg. By all accounts, what's been going on in Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan is far worse than what's been going on in Guantanamo, although there's a chap just been released from Guantanamo who had his eye poked, a British Muslim who had his eye poked out in Guantanamo by a bit of ill treatment. And then, of course, you've got all the allied torture centres in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and so on. What do you think happens to you if you get put in the hands of the Saudi Arabian secret police? Do you think you get your rights? Do you think you get a lawyer? Of course you don't.
Another thing he was talking about there was the endemic racism, the idea that, you know, that the US troops were being inculcated with the idea that these people were sort of Untermensch.
Yeah, well, of course, they keep using the word hadjis or ragheads, just as they used to refer to the Vietnamese as slow pies or gooks. And of course, that's a step beyond, you know, the British calling the enemy in 1981 the Argies or whatever. If you're going to kill people and you're going to misuse them, you have to dehumanise them, and calling them names and thinking of them as less than human is absolutely part of what happens.
And of course, several years ago, the editor of the Bristol Evening Post was ticked off by the Racial Equality Commission for using the word "tailheads" to describe Palestinians. I mean, so it's not totally away from
when people say, "Oh, I've got my human right to say these are offensive things," those same people will say, like when they had the Danish cartoons, if you remember, with the bomb in the turban of Allah, the people who were printing those cartoons weren't doing any favours to the Danish troops who were deployed in southern Iraq at the time, because what they're saying is, you know, if soldiers are going to go and fight in Muslim countries, then in actual fact they're supposed to be trying to get the population on their side. Of course, it's laughable because nobody in these countries actually believes in our good intentions, but let's just presume for a moment that that is what the idea is. Then of course this idea of dehumanising the population means that you're definitely going to lose the guerrilla war that you're in, and they're definitely going to lose in Iraq, and they're definitely going to lose in Afghanistan. All professional assessment of it is that this is an winnable situation.
Okay, let's have a listen now to Iraq Veterans Against the War's co-founder, who's one of the senior people in the organisation. He was actually a United States Marine Corps staff sergeant, also on Venezuelan television, and his name is Jimmy Massey.
We will stay in Iraq until we bleed the Iraqis of all of their oil. And then we will move to Iran, Syria, and whoever else we think has oil or has natural resources that we can rape.
Do you think they would go so far as to take Venezuela's oil by force?
This is World War III. There are no rules. The rules went out the window September 11th.
Is this just your personal opinion, or did someone actually tell you this as your time as a soldier?
My 12 years of intelligence briefings within the U.S. Marine Corps has led me to believe one thing. The U.S. has a quest for global domination. Marines are gangsters for capitalism. I say for all the people here in Venezuela that do not believe in President Chavez, you better start believing. The wolf is north of you. The media within the United States has blinded the American people. And the number one person that has blinded the Americans with propaganda is Bill O'Reilly, Fox News. Mr. O'Reilly is supposedly Irish, but I think he's more fascist.
How many ex-soldiers are in your organization?
We have approximately 600 active members that speak worldwide. And we have 2,000 members that are in reserve that are waiting for the revolution. The revolution has already began. It's just, when are we going to take it to the White House?
You're saying 600 soldiers that are already withdrawn, or are there still some that are active?
The 600 are already withdrawn. And a lot of the 2,000 are members that are still within the U.S. military. And we have members that even work within the National Security Agency in Maryland. We are surrounding them.
Well, that's a pretty confrontational stuff there from Jimmy Massey. He's an ex-United States Marine Corps Staff Sergeant from Iraq Veterans Against the War. And finally today, we're having a quick look at a new film called Four Lions in today's Daily Mirror. Never one to shy away from controversy, brass-eyed satirist Chris Morris's hotly anticipated debut as a movie director is unsurprisingly provocative. And this is a clip from his new suicide bomber comedy.
Liquid peroxide.
3 years of stockpiling.
How'd you get it all?
A wholesale shop down the road.
But all from the same shop?
Yeah.
You mug, you'll get us nicked.
No. I use different voices every time I go in.
Different what? Different voices?
Different voices.
Show me.
What?
Show me the voices, come on.
And one of them's... That's my voice.
Right.
Can I have 12 bottles of bleach, please?
Yeah, I know what that sounds like. Give me another one.
IRA voice. It's
IRA voice? We're terrorists, Fessel. What do you want to do a terrorist voice? You'll get us nicked.
Well, I'll be disguised then, won't I?
Yeah, but as a terrorist.
Now, this is pretty controversial stuff, Martin. Is he going to get away with it?
Well, I mean, I think we do need to laugh at some of the things that have been happening rather than get scared. I think the incompetence of these so-called terrorists is very interesting, comparing them to the IRA. Why are they using peroxide when there's perfectly good what the IRA used to call bag stuff, otherwise known as fertilizer? We've actually got quite a lot of knowledge about bomb-making in this country, and a lot of these boys don't seem to know anything about it. Something suspicious, okay, there, I think.
Well, that's all for this week. Coming up now...